I'm Julia Sherbakov, and this is Impact Journey. Conversations with hidden heroes making big societal change.
Pretty much everyone gets that there's a meta crisis, but we have no vision of how to get out of it. It is genuinely easier to imagine the total extinction of life on Earth than to imagine an end to the death cult. It's the job of writers and artists to imagine the different future and to write the way towards it.
Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Manda Scott. About her impact, Manda is a hard person to introduce. She's probably best known as a best-selling novelist, especially for her historical fiction about Boudicca. But it's two things she did after that that got my attention. First, I got to know her through Accidental Gods, a podcast and membership program she created for people and ideas at the edge of regenerative change. Then I was fascinated by something she's leading called Throughtopia. Beyond dystopia, utopia, this is a clear, engaging storytelling through a world we want, where she's teaching a masterclass for writers and she is writing a Throughtopia novel set to be published in 2024. There are not many examples of Throughtopias out there, but thanks to Manda, we'll soon have many more. Now, about her journey, I want to give a heads up that this is a different conversation than most on this podcast. I just spent some time introducing what Manda is doing since we spend most of our conversation on how she got to be doing all of this, and that is through her shamanic practice and teaching. Now, that is a world I had absolutely zero awareness or knowledge of, and I was uncomfortable and curious about it. So I hope you're willing to get uncomfortable and curious as we dive into this conversation with Manda Scott. I love to start with origin stories. I already know I'm going to have a hard time introducing you because... Looking at your bio, like, you've been a horse veterinarian, a writer, a shamanic teacher, a podcaster, regenerative economics, smallholder. Somewhere you said being normal was never an option. And I'm just so curious, where did that all begin for you? Like, what's the through line there? And where did that originate?
I genuinely have no idea. I grew up in a tiny village south of Glasgow in Scotland. And my mother was a very unusual individual. The house was turned into a rehabilitation center for notionally birds of prey, but actually all wildlife as I was growing up. So there was that. Both my parents, now we would look at them and say, really quite neurodiverse, quite a long way along. My dad was an engineering, professor of engineering. You know, mom did all this. Mom had wanted to be a vet. She was one of those people, frankly, was probably not really cut out to be a wife and mother. If she'd been head of MI5 or something, she would have been just fine. She was deeply underused being a wife and mother. But I was allowed to grow up with my own ideas. You know, this was a very Presbyterian little village. And I was allowed, at the point when I could clearly state why I did not want to go back to church, I was allowed to go and tell the minister that I was not interested in being part of a religion that said that animals were inferior. And he heard me. And then I didn't have to go again.
Wow.
Which was good. It was a long time later I realized that was not normal behavior where I came from.
And the freedom that gave you. And what did you do with that? What came up for you that you were interested in?
Well, I was really interested. The BBC, they made a series of Last of the Mohicans. It just opened all the doors for me. I had no idea about Indigenous peoples, about forage hunting as a way of being. It hit me like a runaway train. And I was this little geeky kid with glasses, and I sat at home reading books all day or playing out in the woods. And I read something called Eagle of the Ninth by Rosemary Sutcliffe. It was mind-blowing because it opened my eyes to pre-Roman spirituality in this land. So basically the shamanic cultures of this land. And there was a particular scene where the hero, who's a young Roman man, they were convinced Romans were good, but he's gone north to try and find the lost Eagle of the Ninth. And it's been taken by, now we would call shamanic indigenous culture. And the priests of the Horn Moon God have this eagle, and they go into the place where they do their work, and you see the goatskin curtain shut, and then they come out, and you never see what's behind the goatskin curtain. And from the moment I read that book, and I was single figures, I was 8 or 9, my life was to know what was happening behind that curtain and to live it and to connect to the Horned Moon in the way the priests of the Horned Moon God. It was just like this whole world opened up. And it was around, I think Last of the Mohicans came a little bit after that, but it was, there are people who do this. It's not just in books. And then my dad took us, me and my brother, to the Brochs, which are prehistoric monuments in Scotland from 3,000-4,000 BC. And they're looking at an unrickle of stones, and I'm walking amongst beings that I could feel and almost hear. And then again, these are the people. These are the people of the Horned Moon God. These are my people, and I need to find a way to talk to them and talk to their God. And the whole of the rest of my life, you know, that was 50 odd years ago. So half a century, that really. And that's not going to be the normal path. And then once you learn to talk to whatever the gods of the land are, the question is, what do you want me to do? And you follow the answer. And again, it doesn't come out of wanting to be different. It just comes out of knowing that I need to know who my people are. And then once I've found a connection to the land that makes sense, asking of it, what do you need of me? And then following the answer, and you just go where you go, because that's what you do.
Oh my goodness, that is so fascinating. It's almost like this journey you've been on is understanding your own heritage and lineage and self, like partly spiritual, but partly ancestral. And
it's more spiritual than ancestral. You know, we're talking hundreds of generations back. So my connections to spirit ancestors are very, very, very long way back. I needed to write about our shamanic past. And in Britain, you grow up, everybody knows about the Boudiccan revolt. It's something you learn in school. You don't learn the right things. The name Boudicca, you know, there's a great big statue of her on embankment by the Thames in London. She is a figure everyone has heard of. If I had gone to my publisher and said, I want to write about Britain's shamanic past, I would still be a vet. But I went and said, I want to write actually what happened with Boudicca. And they went, well, lots of people have written about that. And I went, no, actually, lots of people have written the Roman side. Nobody has written our side. I will write it, trust me. And, you know, 3 chapters in the synopsis, and then they're, oh yeah, this is different. So let's say when I did the vision quest and sat under the tree, what I was told was that I needed to show who we were before the Romans came, because that was our colonization, so that we could see who we could be if we let go of that. I still believe we're at the end of the Roman Empire. We're in the crumbling state. It's interesting, you're in Rome.
Yes.
Because Rome was the enemy for us, and they destroyed so much that was alive and that was connecting us to ourselves and each other in the land.
I'd love to actually dive much more into the how and the what, because you mentioned the tree and your own sort of exploration and connection to how you even know to do this work. And I've heard you talk about asking the tree, asking the hill, asking the fire. And I had never heard about any of these practices. They're not, certainly not taught, in any of the settings I was in. And so I'd love to go down both of these paths with you, and we can hop back and forth between them. The how you even knew to do any of this work for me is so fascinating, that it wasn't like you just sat around or read a bunch of books one day. You didn't do it in that traditional linear way that I certainly did and studied. And you went about it in such a different way. And then the what you came to was also then so different than what sort of anyone is doing. So I don't know which of those to start with, but maybe the how, sort of how did you just even know what shamanic practices mean to you? How did you come across them? That was a long journey.
It's only a long way back. This was the 80s. I mean, really, this is while I was still at vet school already. So you've got a little kid who knows this is what they want to do, aged, let's say 9-ish. And I wanted to be a farmer. My parents, you know, we haven't got a farm, you can't be a farmer. So I ended up as a vet, which did take a lot of study. You know, it's not that I didn't enjoy it, but I led a parallel existence. There was the bit that studied, and there was the bit that didn't go near anybody. I wasn't very good at making friends. I'm not very good at people, really. People are not my thing. So evenings and weekends, I was trying to answer the core question of how do you connect with the gods? And at that point, there were quite a lot of people investigating Druidry in Britain, which was our shamanic past, but it got filtered through a whole bunch of stuff that I don't think is useful. But for me, I was going from Glasgow to Edinburgh. I got a secondhand tent and I just went and slept in the woods from Friday night to Monday morning, just asking, how do I connect? And talking then also with these Druidic people. And then there was a movement in the US where anthropologists had begun to realize that turning up into indigenous tribes and studying them as if they were local wildlife through the lens of white patriarchy was maybe not all the story, and that it might be worth actually listening to what they were saying. A couple of people particularly had begun to do this, and then I'd come back and going, hey guys, there's this whole layer of stuff we didn't know about. And at the same time, some of the North American First Peoples, their gods told them that they had to teach the white people how to connect, because otherwise the white people were going to destroy everything. At the time when I was exploring and talking to people, I was offered an apprenticeship that was going to be between 12 and 20 years.
Oh, wow.
I didn't take it because it was in central Mexico. And also I wanted to connect to the gods of this land, Britain. Mm. And what do you want of me is my core question. And everything that I do, every single thing I do, is aimed towards whatever that is in the moment, but it changes.
That's so fascinating just to hear your journey from the small child curious about this to actually looking into the various ways that exists in your land and other lands, who's doing it, where's the knowledge being sort of held and known and taught.
And those are different things. Held and known are one thing, taught is entirely,
yes.
You know.
And I was actually fascinated by that question that you landed on of what do you want of me that you ask?
Asking of whatever you call the divine, that I the web of life is my kind of baseline, but yes, that whatever you can connect to that is actually real and is not a projection. And that's what takes the 12 to 20 years, is getting past, particularly in the trauma culture that we're in now. You know, if it takes an initiation culture 12 to 20 years to teach the people who are going to hold space, it's lifetimes for us. And
yeah.
And we're probably not going to get there. You know, I have upset quite a lot of people by saying I don't think anyone in the West who's grown and socialized in a trauma culture can be a shaman. We can be shamanic practitioners, though, and that's really powerful and really useful. But that still pisses off a lot of people who want to tell other people that they're shamans. So I don't really care.
But we also have a very ego-driven culture. And it's so counter to, especially the world I come from, of corporate strategy, of five-year plans and 10-year plans in business and in life, of this is what I will do in the next, you know. What I find fascinating about that is the way you were just talking about it too. It really reminds me of something. Do you know Parker Palmer? He's a Quaker elder in the US. He writes a lot about sort of community-based systemic change from a spiritual perspective.
Right.
And
right.
One of the things he says, he's like, actually, it's not about telling life what you want of it, but it's really about letting it live through us. And that shift from the telling to the letting is really, it feels like what you're doing.
Yeah, I would like to think so. Yes, yes, that's a really good way of putting it. It's yes, stop trying to tell the world what you are going to do and ask the world. And as we've got deeper and deeper into the meta crisis, it becomes more and more obvious to me that linear thinking is what got us into this problem, and it is not going to get us out. And it's scary. You know, the what do you want of me, and it might mean a complete change of direction, is not a comfortable place to be.
It's not what we're taught, what we're trained, right? We're taught we are the masters of the universe and that we can then go out into the world and understand it and maneuver it and control it and all of that. And that's why this approach that you have is just so radical to me. And then that's also why the things that came out of it feel so radical too. And the two I'd love to go into, you know, switching from the how to the what, is one is how I found you, which is through Accidental Gods as a project that emerged and has become a community. And then the other one is this idea of a Thrutopia, how you're, as a writer, you're really shifting your focus of the writing and then also bringing that possibility to others. And I'm so curious if you would just sort of speak to both of those, how they came up and like what you've learned and what you're still learning in both of them.
Okay. You're asking big questions.
I know.
So we've established that asking what do you want of me is a thing. Winter solstice, the dark nights, is a time when I would just light the fire and sit with the fire. All the time I was writing the Buddhika books, I was working with the fire. So winter solstice of 2018, what do you want of me? And the answer to that led to Accidental Gods. The interesting thing with Accidental Gods project, two visions at the heart. And one was the Earth as seen from space, all around it, a million, million, million myriad threads, the color of moonlight, crossing and crossing and crossing, all around it like a web. And wherever they crossed was a node of consciousness. And some of those nodes were human and most of them were not. So I was seeing the web of life. And understanding, again, at a really visceral level, that most of the consciousness of the web of life is not human. And yet, what was also very clear is that humanity has something unique to offer. The web needs the people, just as the people need the web. So the second thing, vision, that pushed it, I stopped flying years ago because climate. And yet, I was on a stage in America talking to a whole bunch of people.
That was the vision that came to you.
That was the second vision along with, there were two visions together. One was the blue pearl and this was the other one. And so I was confused. So, okay, these are just visions. And what do I do with these? And 3 days later, I got an email from the States from someone saying, okay, we want to learn from you. By 3 days and a few hours later, I'm organizing to end up in Northeast US in May. And then the question is, what am I going to say? What can I teach that is safe? So a lot of work went into that. And by the time I went to the States in May, I was only part of the way down the line. By the time we got to launching Accidental Gods, which is what arose out of that, exactly on the solstice of 2019, was that conscious evolution needed to happen. And we need to choose it. Conscious evolution can only happen if we want it to happen and if we understand how to help it to happen. And so the Accidental Gods program is, if people want it, you know, put your earphones on and play this 10-minute thing and do what it says. And when you've got that, then do the next one and then do the next one. And there's 6 modules we go and they're endeavoring as much as I can in a safe way without taking people into the real deep stuff that we do with the shamanic dreaming, but enough that anyone who speaks English and can hear will be able to connect to the web of life. And so we launched that. And then the pandemic hit. And we'd had just enough time for me to realize that I was asking too much of people in the early bits. My world is not everybody else's world. And I think that's obvious. So Accidental Gods is a membership program. It's that. And yet I wanted to be able to do stuff in real time. And that's how the podcast arose. So the first 9 episodes of the podcast are just me explaining the neurophysiology and the hypothesis. And then I thought, oh, just talk to a few people. I know lots of those. Shamanic world. And then I thought, oh, let's talk to some economists. And then, you know, 200 episodes down the line, we're talking to the people at the very edge of what Indy Johar called the interbecoming, that emergent edge where everything can change. And it's so exciting. So that's it.
That's such a helpful understanding of how that came together. You know, I'm almost picturing like the merge of your sort of your shamanic inquiry and the master's you did at Schumacher in regenerative economics. And and you wouldn't think necessarily those two worlds meet, but you are at the intersection of those two worlds. You know, what comes out is this program that actually applies these sort of shamanic ways of knowing and the principles of what do we need to create a regenerative society and giving people tools to do that, as you said, at scale. So that's brilliant. So I think that's one. And then Thrutopia sounds like it's sort of the merge of your writing and what you've learned through all of that, through regenerative and the people that you're talking to and how to equip writers and yourself as a writer to do that. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So I was teaching a shamanic course online. It was summer solstice 21. And this time the vision was really clear. I was drumming for them. I don't often get visions while I'm drumming for the students. And this was absolutely clear. It was, I have on my altar, it's extremely old, fossilized horse's tooth. And I had to take that onto the hill on the land where I live. What was a hedge? So the hazel and the, particularly the hawthorn, goes horizontal. I had to get some horse's skin that had been ethically cured. That took me a month. Bind the tooth onto the hawthorn in a very particular place, sit with my back to it as the sun was going down for an hour until further notice. I had to sit in a particular frame of mind.
And that was a vision that you got?
That was absolutely clear. It was clear text. And clear text does not happen often. Usually it can take a year or a decade or a lifetime to work out what a vision means. But this was like, just do this. Okay. And one thing I have absolutely learned is don't argue. Don't ask why. Just do it. So I did it. I sat up the hill. And I sat for a week in the frame of mind as told. And by the end of the week, I had the understanding that I needed to start writing novels again, which I really had dropped, and what it was to be about. And it needed to be mapping a way through from exactly where we are now to the future that works, because everybody is aware that things are very, very bad. The meta crisis, I think, is now pretty much everyone gets that there's a meta crisis, but we have no vision of how to get out of it. It is genuinely easier to imagine the total extinction of life on Earth than to imagine an end to the death cult. It's the job of writers and artists to imagine the different future and to write the way towards it. And we don't. Most of my colleagues are either writing in the midst of business as usual, you know, let me write a crime novel and everything will be happening exactly as it was before. Or I'll write a dystopia because, you know, that's really easy. Everybody knows what it's going to be like when Handmaid's Tale meets the road and limbic behavior becomes the worst of humanity and we all end up kebabbing each other over piles of burning tires. And it's horrible. And everyone writes them going, yeah, but my novel will show people how bad it is and they'll change. And go, no, they can't change. Frightening people into change does not work unless you give them a change to go to. And that realization hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, oh God, yes, I did know this, but why am I not writing the way forward?
Yeah, which is such a change for you, right? You've written historical fiction and that's what you're known for. And you had the more like thrillers, and this is such a shift. So how did you even, say a bit more what a Thrutopia is and how you even sort of arrived at what
Thrutopia, the actual word came from Rupert Read. I thought two things. One is I need to write this book, and I had the outline. I knew that if I hadn't been running the podcast, I would have no idea. If I hadn't gone to Schumacher, I would have no idea. Schumacher was, again, it was another set of visions. We won't go into that, but it was I have to go and do an economics master's. Are you kidding me? I'm a vet. What? Economics? Are you really? Of all the things that I could be doing in the world that I thought were a total waste of time, economics? That is the death cult. But it was at that point the only regenerative economics master's on the planet. It was the only economics degree of any sort that took as its founding principle that the existing system was broken and how could we fix it. So, I learned a huge amount. And if I hadn't learned that, I wouldn't have been able to do Accidental Gods. If I hadn't done Accidental Gods, I wouldn't have had a clue what to write in the book. And then I realized I needed to hold a space, giving people the ideas. Rupert Read, I know Rupert quite well, and I contacted and said, want to do this course? Do you want to speak on it? He went, oh, you're doing Thrutopia. And I went, oh, am I? And he'd written a paper back in 2017 in Huffington Post about the need for this. It has to be the way through. It has to map a route that is plausible to a place that people generally, not just people locked in my bubble, but people who otherwise read the Daily Mail or watch Fox or whatever, could see that they might want to get to and that it would be good. Where the founding values are such that we can all buy into them, because nobody on any part of the political spectrum thinks the world at the moment is going well. Capitalism is over, it's dying. And capitalism and extraction, for me, are so completely intertwined. So extractive systems have to stop. We're in the middle of the sixth mass extinction. In the time you and I have been speaking, another species somewhere has been wiped from the surface of the earth and will never come back. Are you okay with that? And if the answer is no, then we have to change. And we all have to change it. And then you have the letting be, and then you have the letting come. So we had a series of people talking about ideas on urban planning or economics or politics or the media or regenerative farming or whatever. We had 13
And your audience is writers, right?
Yeah, but writers across all the spectrum. We had people who wrote columns in the local newspaper, or people who write blogs, or people who write video scripts for TikTok, or people who write movie scripts. You know, I don't care what you write, poetry, song, theatre, music, anything, whatever you put pen to paper, you're a writer. I'm just going to give you ideas. And then we got publisher. I got someone from Transworld Publishing House. I got somebody who was one of the producers of Harry Potter. We had some relatively big people in the industry. And the question for them was, okay, so we got this new idea. How do we get it through? And universally, they said, you won't get it through our industry because we don't get it. I mean, even though we, the person sitting here, are slightly getting it, the industry will not get it. You are going to have to do this on your own, which I had not expected that at all. But that was useful and interesting and actually right, because I now have a Thrutopian novel that I am not publishing with Penguin Random House. I've been with Penguin Random House for 20 years. Oh, God, I have to change my publisher? Really?
But who better than you, right? Having established yourself.
Yeah, and they're great. And they are all behind it. The entire publishing house is behind this. It's fantastic. It's small. And I'm really happy. But it was, there's always that sense of hurling yourself off yet another cliff, trusting that the parachute is going to be there every single time.
Because what you're doing hasn't been done. So they can't point to, here's how it's successful and how it can make money. And
Also, you're saying, the entire predatory capital model has to go. And you've got a publishing house that knows that it's completely invested in that. It's not going to put that out. So
questioning that. That's so interesting, because what I thought we would be talking about is the Thrutopia itself, right? So the one you're writing right now, the one you're teaching others to write and inspiring them to write by bringing in all of these. But what's interesting, I guess what I didn't quite realize is part of the change you're making is, yes, it's in the what you're writing. It's in what the other people who are taking your Thrutopia masterclass will learn. But it's also the behind the scenes of then what happens to that work, right? And so I'm curious, what are you learning from the writing itself and what this can eventually do in the world?
What I'm learning in the writing itself is 90% of the work gets done in 10% of the time, as ever. That's a bit flippant. But this was one of the reasons why I thought I'd stopped writing novels. It's a long time. And when I started writing The Dangers of AI, were a thing that my tech friends were talking about, but it wasn't in the general news. So we start when we start and we end the day after a general election. And so one of the things that is absolute key to me is that the existing democratic systems are not democratic. We don't have a democracy, we have a kleptocracy. We have psychopaths running the show. And in any healthy initiation culture, the psychopaths are not allowed to run the show. And our culture, the trauma culture, probably for at least 10,000 years, has elevated the psychopaths. So the question is, how do we get around that peacefully in a way that allows us to get to the conscious evolution that we need? Because every single violent revolution there has ever been, the people who ended up at the top of the pile were the psychopaths again.
Yeah, and then repeated the cycle.
Yeah, absolutely repeat the cycle. We haven't stopped the extraction, you know, extract, consume, destroy model for 10,000 years.
And that's what your book is exploring.
How do we do that? You know about Audrey Tang in Taiwan, I'm guessing. I think it was 2014. The students, they stormed the parliament peacefully because the existing government was refusing to hold a debate. Students went in. The Speaker of the House supported them. Audrey Tang is the one who went in with Ethernet cables and made sure the whole of the country saw it and became the youngest digital minister on the planet of the ensuing government. They forked the government. They had Taiwan government .G0V instead of G-O-V, and they created a parallel government. And this is what I'm exploring in the book. The end is the kickoff into, okay, so we've got the newly elected and elected slightly differently because there's been an insurgent set of independents who stood with different values happening in our seat of government that might do radical things. And at that fork, it spreads quite quickly. What happens if you have enough of a way of spreading the information? Because we need political change, we need economic change, we need change in the media. The three need to come together, the three pillars of change. How do we change all of that? If you have a way of distributing the detail of what you're doing, such that people can trust it and they see that what you're doing is different and leads to somewhere that they can see would work, and the existing system is basically powering us off the edge of a cliff, what happens when enough people recognize that what they want is the fork, not the original? I don't know the answer to that because that's the next book.
Oh, you just left me on a cliffhanger there. Now I
yeah. Well, I'm writing.
You've left yourself on the cliffhanger.
Yeah. But I think it's a question that we need to ask. This is why I'm really keen this gets out before the next election, because the system is broken. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing time after time and expecting a different result. Democracy is broken. And so what do we do? And it's not that we lack. Yeah, you know, this is one of the things that I'm learning from the podcast is the answers are out there. We got quadratic voting. We've got all kinds of ways of on the blockchain so you can see it. We've got sociocracy. We've got holocracy. We understand how to do consensus, local, deliberative democracy and to spread that out. The ideas are all out there and they're not hard. And they're quite obviously massively better than the medieval useless crap that we have just now. But the medieval useless crap has the people with the drones and the army and the police. But at the moment, the army and the police are still human beings. And I think while that's the case, we still have a chance.
And in a way, you know, this is where your world really intersects my world. Since I've made the shift from extractive capitalism into hopefully something more regenerative, there's these at least three paths that are starting to come together, which are all different ways and different options that I'm seeing that exist for business. And the three that exist are governance, structures. Right now, often the argument I hear is, yeah, but you know, I'm legally obligated to maximize profit. But like, but did you know, isn't that interesting how we have actually other options where you're not obligated to do that? There are options on the governance front, also on the cultural front. They're like, well, you know, I can't do it because my boss said so. But isn't that interesting? We still end up working in a hierarchy of bosses. And now there actually are so many other ways to make decisions and get things done in teal organizations and things like horlocracy and sociocracy. That's also a choice that we make.
Yes.
And then the last one for me that's sort of emerging much more recently is that inner spiritual one, both individually and collectively, which is, and I've been in the business world for over 20 years. It is so taboo to even talk about feelings or listening to what is important. It's just so counterculture. And yet there are ways to do it, right? And lots of people in the world are doing it. It's just a choice that we make in the business world to not. And that's where I think, you know, your world meets mine, because you're exploring sort of what does that look like from a storytelling point of view. I'm looking at it. What does that look like from a me working directly with business leaders point of view, right? Yeah.
So I think that's brilliant. I think it's brilliant. Because at the moment, everybody knows we were not born to pay bills and die. But the system does not give it, you know, basically who dies having paid the biggest bills wins at the moment, because the most toys are the biggest bills. And that people are afraid to do anything different because they won't be able to pay the bills, whatever those bills are that they feel they need to pay. And yet everybody at core knows we were not born to pay bills and die. That's not why we're here. And if we can, I think moving from the trauma culture to the initiation culture is moving back to, well, what are we here for? And I think we're here to be the little parts of consciousness within the web of life, but that means allowing that freedom to be there. So finding a way to get into business, a sense of asking what we're here for that isn't basically extractive. And if you are able to build that up, I think one of my big aha moments was the realization that every single human being alive on the earth at the moment is part of the web of life, whether we choose to join it or not. However, I don't think we have very long. All of our humanity with each other, deep in the depths of a meta crisis, the like of which we have never seen, but which all of us collectively have played a part in its creation. How do we play our parts in creating something new and different? And what does the something new and different look and feel like? And if we don't know what it does it look and feel like, and we don't know why it looks and feels like something that would make our hearts sing, we are just going to spin the hamster wheels again and again.
Well, and I think what's hard, and again, this is such a deeper level of what you and I are both doing in different ways, is at least the way I was not taught how to be alive in this moment. I was taught how to plan for the future. I was taught how to analyze things from the past, but I was
always on the hamster wheel.
Yes. Yeah. There's so much about the current systems that don't allow for that, especially in the business world that I come from.
And I think the more people that you can have the courage to speak about this in the places where it's not normally spoken of, the more people will be allowed to give themselves permission and then to seek what they need and to acknowledge that what they've got is not what they need.
Oh, that's such a beautiful way to close. You're reminding me of why I wanted to speak to you, because you're one of those people that gives us that window and that permission to look into those really uncomfortable questions we have about this isn't working, but what could. And so I just want to thank you for your brave exploration of that space.
It's been such a joy of a conversation. But I think also we need to say the it's not working is uncomfortable, but that what could, if we let go of all the stuff that we think has to happen and explore what does it feel like if I wake up in the morning and everything is okay? And how is it okay? And it's not okay because I've got enough consumer goods. It's okay because I'm connected.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
Oh, thank you, Amanda, so much.
Me too.
Such a joy.
A big thanks to Amanda. In the show notes, you can find links to her writing, her upcoming book, The Accidental Gods program and podcast, and the Thrutopia Masterclass. And as always, please send feedback and ideas to impactjourneypodcast@gmail.com. This is Impact Journey. See you next time.